Imagine a 51-story skyscraper sheathed in fruit trees, tomato vines, and other nutritious flora to be plucked and harvested by the residents within. Imagine navigating a city using multidimensional maps that point you on a personalized journey created by billions of high-tech sensors. Imagine a one-armed robotic bartender pouring you the perfect Sazerac. Imagine a pavilion whose walls are curtains of falling water. Well, if you do any of that, you've already been beaten to the punch by Carlo Ratti, who holds innumerable titles, patents, and honors. But above all, he's a big thinking polymath, an engineer, architect, educator, author, activist with a vision for improving the world. You'll get a brief tour of Carlo's mind today here on Double Take, the Newton Investment Management podcast that brings you big, bright brains like Carlo's as we explore the myriad themes and issues facing investors and, well, humanity. I'm Rafe Lewis, head of Newton's specialist research teams.
And I'm Newton investigative research analyst Jack Encarnacio. First, folks, a shameless request if we could. If you like Double Take, appreciate the kind of thoughtful dialogue and content we're trying to bring you, please subscribe to the show. Leave us some stars on iTunes or whatever platform you use to listen and write a review. It helps us a lot. So now on to the show. Before we introduce Carlo, I'd like to explicate his many impressive bona fides. Carlo Ratti is a professor of urban technologies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he runs MIT's Sensible City Lab. He's also co-authored over 500 publications. He holds multiple patents, and his work has been exhibited everywhere from the Venice Biennale to New York's Museum of Modern Art. His work was included in Time Magazine's Best Inventions of the Year, and Carlos's name has shown up on any number of best of lists: Fast Company's 50 Most Influential Designers in America, Esquire Magazine's Best and Brightest. Carlo and his co-author Antoine Picon in June also this year published a gorgeous new book at Yale University Press. It's called Atlas of the Sensible City, that is S-E-N-S-E-A-B-L-E, which details in sensuous graphical form how maps are changing and changing us along with them. I better stop because we could fill up this whole show with just accolades for Carlo. Needless to say, Carlo, welcome to Double Take, and we're thrilled to have you.
Thank you. Great to be on the show.
Yeah, Carlo, you're making me feel like I didn't work hard enough all these years. So if nothing else, this is a competitive kick in the backside. So, you know, given your Leonardo da Vinci-esque interests that span the gamut of art and science, engineering, architecture, I have to admit it was a bit of a task preparing for this podcast. You know, we could go in a lot of directions with someone like you. But, you know, we at Newton have been diving into a few investment themes that you have done plenty of work in, namely smart cities and the future of food. And I'd like to, if I could, start with the future of food. You know, put simply, Carlo, is larger scale vertical farming something that we will see in our lifetimes, do you think?
Yeah, well, first of all, maybe let me say something a bit, you know, do a step back. And yes, we've been working on smart cities, on food production in cities and so on. But all of this is trying to reach a better alliance between the natural and the artificial world. You know, we could say that many of the challenges we're facing today, first and foremost, climate change, actually, because we've always considered the natural and the artificial world as two separate, almost competing worlds. And I think the challenge we all face today, and that's what we do in our lab at MIT, we do with our design office and so on, is try to find a better way to merge and to find an alliance between the natural and the artificial. And so going back to your point, you know, bringing more nature in our cities is part of this. It also being bringing more productive nature. So in one project, it's the Jianmu Tower next to Hong Kong in Shenzhen, just you know, in China. In a competition, what we did recently is propose to use the facade of the building for growing food. You know, when you build a skyscraper, one of the key things is actually to protect it from too much incoming radiation to avoid a greenhouse effect inside. And in our case, we said, well, instead of doing that, which means reflecting a lot of sunlight outside and also increasing urban temperatures, well, why don't we let the sun in and use it and turn it into energy, into food, and use it in order, again, to produce with a large hydroponic farm. And it turns out when you do all the calculation, this can be quite effective. You need to use quite a bit of robotics, but you know, robotics is more and more increasingly employed in hydroponic farms. And not only you can produce food, you know, salad, according to estimates, for over 10,000 people, but also, you know, you create a very interesting experience for people inside, you know, looking at the outside in the city through this kind of green lens or embroidery in the facade of the building.
Very interesting, Carlo. I was reading up on vertical farming and a couple of things I'd love to get your thoughts on. Some challenges, you know, that sort of present themselves to pulling this off. Water, of course, is required in abundance. That's an increasingly scarce resource. You know, many large urban areas in the U.S., let alone the rest of the world. So we wonder if it's possible to really deliver the quantities of water in like an L.A. or a Phoenix that, you know, deal with very arid conditions, but also the amount of LED lighting, I guess, required to pull off vertical farming is actually an environmental challenge to reflect the appropriate amount of light on these plants to promote growth. Your thoughts on a couple of those challenges?
Yeah, those are very important challenges. You know, from the water side, you recycle all the water. When you do hydroponic, you know, yes, some of the water is turned into salad, into whatever you're growing, into vegetables or fruits. But somehow you can do it in a way that you use very little water, especially very little water when you compare this with the more traditional ways of farming. Regarding the second point, is also very important. Some people are doing hydroponic farming in, call it in a black box, and then using a lot of LEDs. Well, you're right. If you do that, it means you need to take, you use a lot of electricity. And that's not very effective. Think about this, you know, if you're growing with sunlight, all the incoming light is what you get from the sun. If you're growing with LEDs, it means you take, in a sustainable way, then you take sunlight, you use photovoltaics, but then you lose 80-90% of the incoming radiation and turn it into electricity. And then you lose still a little bit in order to go back to light with LEDs. So certainly, you're right, you know, the process is not very efficient. Now, in our case, like before, somehow we're harvesting most of the sunlight already hitting the facade of the building. And yes, there's a bit, you supplement it a little bit during the night with LEDs, but not that much. So the issue about LEDs is going to be a very important thing looking forward. Clearly, it's much easier to do what we've done for forever in agriculture, simply to use sunlight as it hits the earth.
So, Carlo, back to the initial question then, do you think we will see large-scale urban farming in our lifetimes, something that could actually start to support meaningful populations?
I would say already today, you know, when you go to the supermarket and you buy salad, you know, most of that in the U.S. or in Europe, you know, most of that is actually being farmed with hydroponics somewhere. And it can be hydroponics with sunlight, it can be with LEDs, as you were saying, the different technologies. And I think we'll see more and more of that closer to our cities. So it's already happening. But again, by bringing it closer to our cities, we can have better production and use less energy in order to move things around. So I would say it's already happening. And I think we'll continue growing in this direction. It makes sense. Also from a sustainability point of view, if you've got a controlled environment, for instance, you don't need pesticides. You know, you can be much, you can grow in an organic way much better.
That's terrific. So when we talk about the new normal in developed economies, and we think about office buildings, you know, many of these fully empty office towers, street level retail that may have been hollowed out, you know, during the course of and after the pandemic, more and more people opt to work remotely, hybrid fashion, at least. I'm curious where your creativity takes you as you see all of these tall, underutilized real estate assets across major cities in the globe.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point. I had a meeting at MIT a few days ago, and a number of people were here and said, you know, well, that's, I said, you know, that's a $1 billion question. And they said, no, that's a $50 trillion question. I believe 50 trillion trillions is the value of all the office stock we have globally on the planet or something like that. I don't remember the exact number. But so that's a very, very important question. Now, let me tell you two competing forces. On the one hand, we know now that people want more flexibility in their lives. We know now that, you know, it's over a year that we've all gone back to work, and still, you know, in New York, office occupancies in across the United States is a 50% more or less of what it was before COVID. So people want more flexibility, want to do some smart working. And, you know, let's face it, if you just need to reply to emails or do something like that. Why would you want to commute and waste, you know, half an hour, 1 hour, 2 hours every day when you can actually do the same things exactly from home? At the same time, we've done a bit of research at MIT, research that happened a bit accidentally. We were collecting data before COVID, data about the social network, about how people communicate with each other on MIT campus. And then, no, lockdown happened. And lockdown was kind of the experiment you normally, you can never do in the social sciences. You take one variable, in this case, physical space, and you remove it from the equation. And then at the end of lockdown last year, you know, basically you bring back the variable. And then you can see over time what happens to communication networks, what happens to the way we interact with other people. And what we discover is actually physical space is very, very important, that if you don't meet in physical space, a lot of connections, especially what sociologists call weak ties, so connections with people who are not the people, you know, we see every day in the office and so on, but this kind of friends who are not friends of our friends, but who are very important in order to expose us to new ideas, to new ways of thinking and so on. You know, if we still meet the people, the friends of friends and so on, this kind of closely knit group, we tend to tell each other always the same story. When actually it has been very well documented in sociology that a lot of the new ideas, a lot of the creativity, it comes from these kind of weak ties. So we got these kind of two competing forces. On the one hand, people want to have more flexibility in the way we arrange our lives. You know, we can spend some time at home from the countryside, working from home, the countryside, the mountains, anywhere on the planet. At the same time, it's very important to be together in the same physical space, because that's where the magic of human interaction happens. That's where, you know, thanks to weak ties, we make new connections and we can be creative together. And then when you look at those two competing forces, I think we need to find a new equilibrium. And a few months ago, together with Ed Glaser, Ed is the head of the economics department at Harvard University. So together we did an op-ed, an editorial in the New York Times, where we hypothesized that this could be the beginning of a new city. We called it the playground city. And the playground city would be a city that allows us to meet, but in new ways. We don't want to meet anymore in the old cubicle. It doesn't make sense. If you need to go to a cubicle, you might well work from your kitchen table. But actually, we need to find new ways for the city to bring us together, because only together in physical space, we can be more creative and enjoy better the things we do every day.
Arlo, for those who are living in the traditional urban downtown cores, you know, many of them are impoverished, it's crowded, you know, you hear the term food desert quite a bit. There's just a lack of high quality food, of access to decent markets. It's much more heavy on processed and fast food. I'm curious to hear where your head goes. What kind of investments are really necessary to, you know, close that gap and to bring the food supply and quality of supply up to code, as it were, in these cities?
Yeah. And that's another very, very important point. I don't think we can really solve these issues just by legislation, by putting incentives, by subsidizing. You know, the way to solve such issues is really to start from the new behavior, as a new behavior, the new normal post-COVID, embrace it, and then making sure there's enough density of activities so that all the other activities, such as food and beverage and so on, will sustain themselves and will become, again, very very rich and provide a rich offer to residents and to people using the city. So I really think that the starting point is, you know, somehow we shouldn't focus on the symptoms. We should really look at the cause of the malaise, and I think that that is something that starts from really understanding better what the new normal post-COVID is, embracing it, turning that into architecture, into urban planning, and then as a consequence of that, then we'll also have a very lively offer of everything, you know, from food and beverage all the way to other opportunities in our street, in our cities, and on our streets.
Carlo, as we sort of look out on the vision you see for the highest tech, sort of most advanced, forward-thinking cities in the next decade or two decades. I wonder, what technologies do you see in there as most impactful to making these cities sort of leading edge? Which technologies and what cities maybe today offer us that best preview of the future?
It's I don't think we can really look at it this way. In the sense that solutions are going to be dependent on where you are going to be dependent on climate, on, you know, emerging countries will have different solutions from Western countries. So I think, you know, it's going to be difficult to find one technology fits all or to find one solution for every city. I think what we should do is promote a very lively ecosystem, a little bit similar to what happens in venture capital. In venture capital, you try many ideas, you finance a lot of ideas at the beginning, 9 out of 10 will collapse, but one will merit going forward. And then if you look at phase 2, again, you've got a bunch of ideas and 9 out of 10 will again collapse, but then some of them will continue. And by doing that, you might actually find something that will really have a big impact on the planet. And I think we need to do something similar in our cities. So the important thing, I don't think it's about this technology or that technology, and there's not going to be the same technology being successful or that can be applied in every city. It's more about, you know, promoting this kind of richness of innovation and then making sure that different cities find the best solution, but the best solution for them.
And is there a particular forward-looking city that you would have us look at that's doing this process well right now?
Many cities are looking at this idea of becoming living labs in order, again, to promote innovation, living lab sandboxes and so on. Again, I don't think there's one city that's doing this across the spectrum. But if you look at today, for instance, you could say that Singapore is doing a lot of experiments related to mobility, everything from self-driving to other type of sustainable mobility, electric mobility, and so on. So a city such as Copenhagen is actually focusing more on decarbonization technologies. Boston is focusing a lot on new technologies to engage citizens. There's an office here called the New Urban Mechanics, you know, turning people, Bostonians, into mechanics of the city. Or Milan is experimenting a lot with the idea of bringing nature much closer to us, you know, nature on buildings, in the middle of buildings, in the city center. So I think different cities are looking at different dimensions of this. But the important thing is really to use cities as living lab where new solutions can be found.
Very, very interesting. So, Carlo, last question from us. You know, your Atlas of the Sensible City and Double Take listeners, I really can't overstate what a beautifully designed and really nicely written book this is. You discuss how all this smart city sensing technology that's proliferating in our urban areas is a double-edged sword, how it allows governments to exert control, you know, even as it allows citizens to communicate and organize and exert their power. And so I guess I'd love to have you peer into your crystal ball a little bit. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when people were very excited about technology, and these days people are much more nervous about a dystopian future. But if you look out, say 20 years from now, you know, how do you think all this technology will change urban life in places like Milan or London, New York, Boston?
Yeah, and I often get this question about, you know, how is the city of tomorrow going to look like? And you know, can you tell us about future cities in 10, 20, 50, 100 years? And so just a couple of caveats. The first one is, you know, the future is not something we should predict. The future is something that we should all build together. And that's something that was actually discussed in a very interesting way by Karl Popper, the great philosopher. You know, the fact that the future is open, it's not predetermined. And for this very reason, it cannot be predicted. Incidentally, if you look at Boston, if you look at the Boston Globe and on the 1st of December 1900, they tried to imagine life in the year 2000. And of course, you know, they extrapolated from what was happening at the time, but they certainly couldn't see the biggest changes coming from the internet to Uber to self-driving and so on. You know, they were just thinking about travelators everywhere and you know, extrapolating from the technology of the time. So that's a little caveat I want to start with. And the other caveat is cities, the physical appearance of cities will not change that much. you know, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but if you look at cities, you know, in some parts of the world, people are still living today in buildings that were actually built 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago in Roman times. So the urban fabric is quite stable. As humans, we need horizontal floors to move. We need facades to protect us from the elements. We need windows to look outside. So all those elements were there 2,000 years ago, will be there tomorrow. Yes, you know, you get a bit of experimentation, new material, new shapes, but somehow the physical appearance of cities will not change it much. But as you said, what will change a lot is actually the way to live the city. And think about how much they changed over the past 5 or 10 years. Also, just during COVID, the way to buy things, to shop, to get food, to meet people, to connect and so on, to work. And so I think we'll see a lot more changes across these dimensions. So somehow the way to sum it up is the hardware is quite permanent. And I don't think we'll see that many changes. But actually the software is mutating much faster. And that's what we should focus on. And going back to your point about technology, then the software, yes, can go in different directions. It's really up to us to look at what's happening, to look at technology, and to decide how we want to use it. So I think my suggestion would be all of us as citizens, we should be well informed about what is going on, about new technologies, so that we can together decide what type of city we want. Not just let technology take the lead, but actually we should decide what type of technology we want or we don't.
Well, Carlo Ratti of MIT's Sensible City Lab, we want to thank you very much for joining us on Double Take and helping us at least glimpse a future that's very much in development.
Thank you for having me.
This is a financial promotion for institutional clients only, issued by Newton Investment Management North America, LLC, NIMNA, or the firm. NIMNA is a registered investment advisor with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, and subsidiary of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation, BNY Mellon. The firm was established in 2021, comprised of equity and multi-asset teams from an affiliate, Mellon Investments Corporation. The firm is part of the group of affiliated companies that individually or collectively provide investment advisory services under the brand Newton or Newton Investment Management. Newton currently includes NIMNA and Newton Investment Management Limited, NIM, and Newton Investment Management Japan Limited, NIMJ. Any statements of opinion constitute only current opinions of NIMNA, which are subject to change and which NIMNA does not undertake to update. This publication or any portion thereof may not be copied or distributed without prior written approval from the firm. Statements are correct as of the date of material only. This document may not be used for the purpose of an offer or solicitation in any jurisdiction or in any circumstances in which such offer or solicitation is unlawful or not authorized. The information in this publication is for general information only and is not intended to provide specific investment advice or recommendations for any purchase or sale of any specific security. Some information contained herein has been obtained from third-party sources that are believed to be reliable, but the information has not been independently verified by NIMNA. NIMNA makes no representations as to the accuracy or the completeness of such information. No investment strategy or risk management technique can guarantee returns or eliminate risk in any market environment, and past performance is no indication of future performance. ESG analysis refers to a range of internal and external qualitative and quantitative research. Newton manages a variety of strategies. Whether and how ESG considerations are assessed or integrated into Newton strategies depends on the asset classes and/or the particular strategy involved, as well as the research and investment approach of each Newton firm. ESG may not be considered for each individual investment, and where ESG is considered, other attributes of an investment may outweigh ESG considerations when making investment decisions. Analysis of themes may vary depending on the type of security, investment rationale, and investment strategy. Newton will make investment decisions that are not based on themes and may conclude that other attributes of an investment outweigh the thematic structure the security has been assigned to. If distributed in the UK, EMEA, Australia, New Zealand, this podcast is issued by Newton Limited and may be deemed a financial promotion. Newton Limited is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, 12 Endeavour Square, London, E20, 1JN, in the conduct of investment business. Registered in England, number 01371973. NIM is also registered as investment advisors with the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, to offer investment advisory services in the United States. If distributed in Canada, this podcast is issued by either Newton Limited, which is availing itself of the International Advisor Exemption, IAE, in the following Canadian provinces, Alberta, British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec. The IAE is in compliance with National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations, or NIMNA, which is availing itself of the IAE in the following Canadian provinces, Alberta, British Columbia, and Manitoba. The IAE is in compliance with the National Instrument 31-103, registration requirements, exemptions, and ongoing registrant obligations.